Thought Leadership from PwC's National Office.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. Since the SEC's climate proposal first came out in March 2022, there's been much speculation and anticipation about when a final rule may be out and, perhaps more importantly, what would be in it. Last week, on March 6, 2024, we finally saw our answer with the SEC's approval of the final rule. At over 800 pages, in fact, close to 900, there's a lot in the adopting release to discuss. It covers climate-related topics ranging from strategy, targets and goals, greenhouse gas emissions, to financial statement disclosures. Joining me today on the podcast is Kyle Moffitt, Kevin Vaughn, and Valerie Wieman. We've all been following the proposal closely and have already spent a lot of time with the new rule. Want to understand what's in there? Stay tuned to hear our conversation. Welcome to the podcast for a long-awaited episode. I think we've been waiting for this episode since the fall of 2022, which was when we originally thought the SEC climate rules would come out. So it's a very exciting day and very happy to have Kyle, Kevin, and Val here with me to talk about the rules, give an overview, and then for the benefit of the listeners, this is just the first of many podcasts on this. So today we'll talk about the basics, and then next week you can tune in for some of the initial frequently asked questions. Now, for those of you who have been paying close attention to the original rule, we will give some highlights of where things have changed, but mostly we're going to just try to focus on what the rule actually says to keep it from getting too confusing. And for those of you who haven't looked at it, the rule itself is almost 900 pages, including all the commentary and everything else. So definitely a lot to get through. And I would highly recommend reading through some of the reasoning because it is interesting the way they laid it out in terms of what they originally proposed, what the commenters said, and then why they landed where they did. So if you want some additional insight, recommend you check that out. But to start things off, maybe Kyle, I'll turn to you, sort of give an overview. And don't worry, listeners, we'll get into more detail on all of this. But maybe if you want to give a quick overview of the rule, and then probably most of something that will be of interest to a lot of the audience is just sort of what we heard from the commissioners and how they voted on the rule.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I'll start with kind of the disclosures that are required. And then I'll talk a little bit about what's not required or kind of what is out, just to kind of level set. So for large accelerated filers and certain accelerated filers, so those that are not SRC, smaller reporting companies and emerging growth companies, you'd have a requirement to disclose scope 1 and scope 2 greenhouse gas emissions if material. You'll have to disclose the impact of climate-related risks on the financial statements. Describe climate-related risks that have or are reasonably likely to have a material impact. Describe risk management and oversight, governance of climate-related risks, which we'll obviously get into all these details. Disclose climate-related targets and goals, internal carbon pricing, scenario analysis, transition plans. And I think the interesting piece about a lot of this is it will apply to all registrants. The footnote disclosures will apply to all registrants. They're going to apply to foreign private issuers as well, which I think we fully expect it to see. The forms, we'll see this in a number of forms. We'll see it in Form 10-Ks. We'll see it in Form 20-F. Registration statements will require this information. I mean, obviously, compliance dates, they are right around the corner, and I think that's another thing. We'll talk a little bit more detail about that. And then, of course, the assurance requirements that we'll see. I mean, obviously, the requirements to limited assurance and reasonable assurance over greenhouse gas emissions data, and that is an extended phase-in period. And then, of course, you know, reasonable assurance will ultimately be required for large accelerated filers down the road. And I guess what's not in the final rule, you know, obviously disclosure of scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions no longer it's not a requirement. You know, the change there of disclosure of scopes 1 and 2 greenhouse gas emissions only required if certain issuers and if material. So I think that's also a piece that was scaled back. And then of course the financial statement footnote disclosures no longer required essentially in the form that they proposed. So when you look at each financial statement line item, you had to walk through this kind of framework to determine what's material. And so that has been scrapped for a more I guess, focused in materiality assessment. Obviously, there are certain thresholds as well there. Final rule is essentially going to be effective. I mean, obviously, there's a lot, at stake here with respect to challenges. We'll potentially see legal challenges. We've already seen some lawsuits, probably fully expect to see more challenges, could see some congressional action that could certainly influence kind of the direction that this ultimately heads. But the final rule will be effective once they post it or publish it in the Federal Register. It'll be 60 days after publishing in the Federal Register. As far as your second question, I think it was very interesting to see kind of, each of the commissioners and kind of they each had lengthy statements. As we all know that this is very political issue, we do see that it's a vote that went down party line. So three Dems voted in favor, two Republicans voted against. So you essentially had Commissioners Ueda and Commissioner Peirce both vote or dissent. And frankly, the reason that they essentially focused on was they don't believe the commission really had the authority to require greenhouse gas emissions disclosure. So a lot of questions around the statutory ability to actually propose and then finally adopt rules. But on the flip side, you have Commissioner Crenshaw, who wasn't happy with the final rule. She expected that there would be more, didn't go far enough. Why didn't you require Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions? And even the push at one point in time to have that information audited. So I think there's a lot of noise. Overall, not a surprise, the reactions from the various commissioners. But again, right down the partisan, vote there. So fully expect that we'll see a lot more noise, especially from Congress in the coming months.
Yeah. So, Kyle, the one thing maybe I take exception to that you just said is implementation is right around the corner. I mean, fiscal year is beginning in 2025. It's not exactly right around the corner, but it is soon.
It is soon. That's the thing is a lot of people will say like, hey, we got a punt. But as far as readiness, and we talk about readiness,
yes,
and timing,
fair enough.
People need to start to get engaged now.
Okay, that's definitely fair. But maybe, again, before we go on and get into some of the details, I do think a lot of what you talked about, the change, there had been discussion in the press and otherwise. So I don't think there were many surprises from that perspective. But was there anything in the rule that stood out to you as either more than you expected, less than you expected, or just directionally you were surprised something that they did?
I don't think I was really surprised with the direction that they headed. I think largely we were kind of able to predict where they might end up because of all the noise, because of all the pressure from Capitol Hill, the commenters and kind of what we've heard from preparers. So I would say the thing that probably stood out most was, at least to me, the impacts of financial statement footnote disclosures that all companies will have to report mm-hmm. this information in their footnotes. And so a lot of the conversations that Kevin and I have been having about how does that impact a company that is, down the road, they're going to go public. They're going to be thinking about essentially public reporting, FASB standards that would apply to them. So you think about the segment footnote that would apply to a new public company, EPS, new public company mm-hmm. disclosure requirements. And here you would have climate. So you're adding or layering something else on top of that for a company that's going through the IPO process. So I think that was one thing I think that surprised me.
All right. Well, let's get some into the rules and then we can talk a little bit more about surprises and changes as we go along. So, Kevin, I'm going to start first pulling off of something Kyle said about materiality. And obviously we saw specific, I'm going to use words materiality in terms of greenhouse gases, because those disclosures for companies and scope of those disclosures are if material, which I have a few views on that myself. We also saw some very specific thresholds that were set for the financial statements, which again, some people, there could be a question how that fits in more broadly from a materiality perspective. But taking a big step back, obviously, we're still focused on investor materiality, but what can you share here?
Yeah, no, materiality definitely featured front and center, I think, throughout the final rule. A number of qualifiers were added to make it clear that the disclosures were triggered off of materiality. And importantly, when they set that out, they made clear, as we expected, that materiality is evaluated using the existing securities law framework. And so if you think back, and these have come up in other conversations recently for other new rules, but just to refresh, the Supreme Court has said that a fact is material if there's a substantial likelihood that a reasonable investor would consider it important in connection with their investment decision-making process, or if the omission of the disclosure would significantly alter the total mix of information. So that's kind of the broad definition. There's a lot of judgment, as we know, in applying that when companies have to evaluate a whole lot of different qualitative, quantitative factors. And so it's really important to Kyle's point about it being right around the corner. I think those materiality discussions need to start now, because we know from other discussions as well, from, like, if you go back to the cyber rules,
yeah,
people spend a lot of time trying to think through how do we evaluate materiality, and how do we put in a process that can withstand scrutiny by the regulator, because once these disclosures come in, right, you're certainly going to have questions from the SEC and potential exposure there. So you want to make sure that you build in a robust process. And I think it's important to remember too, because we are talking, some of this is quantitative, some of this is financial statement related. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't remind that, yes, because I think this audience is very familiar with SAB 99 and the evaluation there. But I think that's just one evaluation, and reminder that that's specific to evaluating the materiality of an error in the financial statements. So it's a little bit different than what we're evaluating from this perspective. So I think, you know, when you think about this materiality, it's going to be similar to the materiality evaluations that companies do today in connection with risk factor disclosure, MD&A disclosure, and things like that.
So is it too soon to ask what we would think about a company that says that this is not material?
I think, well, you know, it's interesting because we've been having this conversation a lot in the last couple of days. I think when you think about the fact that there are companies today that might be disclosing risk factors that suggest that it could be material, I think that's going to be something they're going to have to think through, because risk factors are supposed to be focused on material items. And so, you know, what's the process that goes through the evaluation and conclusion that it's material from a risk factor perspective? But then maybe, you know, how would you reconcile that with then also concluding that it's not material for purposes of these new disclosures?
Yeah. And I think this is definitely a topic we'll get into some more in some of our follow-up podcasts, but just wanted to sort of whet the appetite there with that question. And I do think there's some specific considerations, again, when we get into GHG, that we can talk about separately. But sort of then diving into the rule, Kyle, maybe starting with the top level. So obviously governance is a big part of the rule. It's also a big part of, you know, the rules that we saw come out from the ISSB and in the EU, because all coming from TCFD, Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. So what is required then from a governance perspective?
Yeah, so you know, the final rule does require registrants to describe, you know, board oversight of climate-related risk, and obviously management's role in respect of climate risk. Kind of with respect to the first piece there of board oversight, companies will have to disclose, you know, any board or identify any board or committee or subcommittee responsible for climate-related risk as applicable. You know, obviously the begs the question of, well, if you don't have that, then what would you have to disclose? And I think the answer would be, well, if your board does not have or does not oversee climate risk, then that's something you certainly would need to state. And that would be something you would disclose, likely disclose. The processes by which the board or relevant committee or subcommittee actually is informed about climate risk, you know, if applicable. So I think, you know, it feels a lot like, and Kevin, you mentioned this, cybersecurity, right? I mean, I think that there's a lot of common themes here. And then, of course, you know, whether and how the board oversees progress against, let's say, a disclosed transition plan, or if you had climate-related targets or goals, essentially, if you have any of those set up, then you're going to have to talk about it. So, look, I think that, you know, very, very interesting with respect to how they considered this climate and looking at cybersecurity and thinking about, okay, this is a model that works. Let's use this. Companies were satisfied with what was ultimately adopted with respect to cyber. And I think the SEC certainly felt comfortable with what they ultimately adopted with respect to governance. I think that the big piece that was different, right, was the fact that companies don't have to identify or disclose a particular board member that has expertise in climate-related risks. So I think that was obviously a welcomed change by a lot of boards.
All right. And so I have many questions that I'll save for the next episode. Val, moving on then to strategy, what are the key disclosures there?
So they call it strategy, but this is really the core of the disclosures, right? So this is where you need to get into your climate-related risks. So within the final rule, they require companies to disclose the physical and transition climate risks that have materially impacted or are reasonably likely to materially impact your strategy or your financial statements over the short or the long term. Now, that's pretty close to how it was described in the original proposal. I actually like that they dropped the description of a medium term. That was kind of arbitrary. So they look at the short term, which is that 12-month period, and then beyond that term. Now, once you have your risks, they do require companies to determine if you have a physical risk, whether it's acute or chronic, so basically one time or an ongoing condition. And the other welcome approach is that if it was a physical risk, the proposal said that you should disclose the zip code level of detail of the location of the assets or the operations that were subject to that risk. And now it's just more of a broad-based description of the location.
So Val, if we were going to then just give a quick example here of something that's acute versus chronic, acute would be if there's a huge wildfire or risks of wildfires.
Or a hurricane.
And
or
a hurricane. Yes. And versus chronic, for example, would be extreme water shortage. And
or those sea level rising, right, longer term.
All right, that's helpful. And then how about then next area, transition risks?
So the transition risks, you need to say whether those are sort of the nature of that transition risk. So you'd look at whether it was a regulatory basis, whether it was a technological advancement or market related. So by that, I mean sort of changes in consumer demand or the market for your products. And then you would also need to consider how those risks, so both the physical and the transition, were considered in the company's strategy, financial planning, or capital allocation. So basically, what have they done now that they've identified those risks? I think when I talk about strategy, I also look to the transition plans. So again, if you have those transition risks, you would need to have a disclosure about the transition plan to manage those risks, as well as your progress under those plans. And then I think Kyle mentioned in the beginning, sort of on top of that, is if you're using scenario analysis to identify material risks, you'd have to talk about your scenario analysis. And if you use internal carbon pricing to manage material risks, you'd have to have some additional disclosures about that as well.
So Val, you mentioned transition plans in the context of transition risks. So what if I have an identified transition risk and I do not have a plan?
Well, then to me, you would not then have the disclosure. So it's triggered off of the identification of a transition risk. So if you have a material transition risk and a plan to address it, you would need to disclose the plan. I think, I don't know whether you'd have to disclose actually that you don't have a plan, but it'd be a little bit odd to have a risk.
Yeah.
Would you have to say that you don't have a plan?
Yeah. So I think that's important. And I do think, you know, we talked a bit about how CSRD and the EU rules are intended to change behavior. In some ways, there's some subtle notes of that in here, too. And I think that would be one of the cases that we see that. So definitely something for companies to think about. And I also just think, to your point, it is helpful that they got rid of the medium term, because I do think that was all a bit arbitrary, although differentiating beyond 12 months as long term is also, that's not normally how we think about long term.
Right.
Although I guess it matches up with the financial statements, for example, long term debt.
Yeah,
so it would match up with that. So maybe that's where that's coming from. All right, Kyle, back to you for risk management.
Yeah. So and I think kind of layering on kind of some of the points that Val was mentioning, it's really highlighting management's role in assessing and managing climate related risks. So the disclosures that would be required would be whether and which management positions or even committees, if a committee is set up, is responsible for assessing and managing climate-related risks. And of course, the relevant expertise of those persons on the process for assessing and managing such risk. And then, of course, whether those positions or even a committee actually reports to the board or some other committee of the board, whether it's the audit committee or whoever responsible for kind of the oversight there. Again, pretty consistent with what we've seen with cybersecurity.
All right. Targets and goals, Kevin.
Yep. So there's similar to the theme we have here. There's a materiality trigger here as well. So if the company has targets and goals that have affected or are reasonably likely to materially affect the business results or financial condition, then that's when disclosure would be triggered here. Much like some of the other things, there's not a requirement that you have targets or goals, just that if you do, then that's when the disclosures come into play. GHG emissions reduction is kind of the common one that we see, but it's not specific to that. It can be any sort of target or goal. And then when you do trigger the disclosure, they have some specific information to provide on there, the scope of activities, the unit of measurement for that goal, what your time horizon is for achieving that, and then also if it's connected to a regulatory requirement. So if you think about if the targeted goal is because your regulator or some government or some law established that you have to meet this, then investors are going to be interested in understanding that mandate. And then more information on how the company plans to meet the goal, how it's going to be tracked and things like that. And then there'd also be disclosure. Each year you need to update disclosure on your progress towards achieving those targets and goals, as well as any actions that you've taken related to those. And then there's also a qualitative and quantitative disclosure. And this kicks in, it's on a delayed basis from when the first disclosure kicks in on this. But qualitative and quantitative disclosure of the material expenditures and impacts associated with your targets and goals and your efforts to meet those targets and goals.
All right. And then maybe one clarification there, because you mentioned it's not just GHG, but it's any targets and goals, any climate related
yes.
targets or goals. So, for example, biodiversity would not fall into this category. But I think right. maybe an example of something you're saying then, it's like if you had a target that you're going to move all of your operations out of hurricane zones or something like that could right. be a non-GHG related, climate related target or goal.
Right.
All right. That's definitely helpful. And then again here, if you have these targets or goals, is there any, what if it's internal only, or what if it's just a division in my company that has the target?
Yeah, no, it doesn't set any specific requirements. It's just that materiality. If the target and goal is material, is going to materially impact or reasonably likely to materially impact the business, then it triggers a disclosure. So it could be at a lower level of the entity. It doesn't have to go through the board approval. It doesn't have to be publicly announced even. It's just that materiality analysis focused on the financial impacts, the financial statement impacts.
All right. I know we'll be getting a lot of questions on that one, so maybe more to come in the next episode. So the next topic before we move over to the financial statement requirements would be GHG emissions. And this is probably one of the areas of the proposal that got the most questions. And at least in my view, one of the areas where we did see the most amount of changes. And so we are going to be doing a specific episode just covering GHG. So we'll hit the highlights here. But maybe, Val, if you want to start, and then I'm sure I will want to add on because this is what I've been most focused on.
I was going to say, I'm very conscious of the fact that you're one of the experts on greenhouse gases, but I can handle the higher level ones. So from a high level perspective, the greenhouse gases would be required to be disclosed by large accelerated and accelerated filers. So your scope one emissions, which are basically your direct emissions, and then your scope two emissions, and those are really your purchased electricity, heating, and cooling. So that was a big change from the original proposal. And then, as Kyle mentioned in the beginning, there is no requirement for scope three, which I think that was a welcome change for many. Which part of that was a lot of the concern that was raised during the comment letter process that we talked about in the beginning was that it had that value chain impact of scope three really brought into scope of the SEC rule a lot of private companies. So there is no scope three requirement. The other thing I think is helpful is a lot of the concern was about the timing of creating your greenhouse gas emissions disclosures consistent with the timing of filing your 10K financial statements. So there was a relaxing of the timing, so you can submit those emissions as late as the date when you file your second fiscal quarter's 10Q. So it's similar to how you would do proxy, so you're basically forward incorporating it. But I think that that delay in the timing was really welcomed. And then with some other changes relative to, it spoke a little bit more clearly in the proposal about using the greenhouse gas protocol, or at least it referenced a lot of the definitions and the methodology for the greenhouse gas protocol. And here you can actually use the protocol, but you can also use other standards. And part of that, and related to that, is sort of that organizational boundary or sort of the scope of your emissions, where it used to be very firmly tied to your financial statements, and now they talk more about disclosing your policy on organizational boundaries and really describing what's in your disclosures.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Val, this is one of the most interesting changes in my view, because in the original proposal, they actually said they were basing it on the GHG protocol, but that they, in fact, were sort of defining these things themselves. So they had their own definition of scope 1, 2, and 3, and then their own rules. And they continue to have their own disclosure rules. But as you said, they referenced the GHG protocol, EPA, and other sources as potential ways to do your measurement. And then again, you would have to follow the SEC disclosure. All right. Again, we'll spend more time on that particular topic in the standalone episode, but perhaps Kevin. So I think one of the areas where we did see a lot of change, but perhaps not as much as companies were hoping for, were in the financial statement disclosures. Obviously, that got a lot of attention in the original proposal. We did see a bit of scale back, but I think perhaps commenters saw a lot more scale back from a GHG perspective. So where did we finally land with the footnotes? What's the area and what's required to be disclosed?
Yeah, so there's a couple categories in the footnote disclosures. Maybe the first category, which is the quantitative type of analysis that I'll talk about, relates to capitalized costs, charges, expenses, expenditures expensed, and also losses. And it's all related to severe weather events or other natural conditions. So kind of those events that we were talking about earlier, you know, hurricanes, storms, things like that. So those disclosures, they retain the 1% threshold for disclosure, which I think was a little bit of a surprise from the proposal. I think everybody expected that there'd be some movement there, maybe a different threshold. So they retained 1%, but it's relative to a different denominator, basically. So the first category is absolute value of the capitalized cost and charges related to severe weather events and other natural conditions. And that's compared to total stockholders' equity. So if it's more than 1% of the absolute value of total stockholders' equity, then you would trigger disclosure unless it was under 500,000. They put in kind of that threshold. If it's under 500,000, then you won't have to disclose. The second category is expenditures expensed as incurred and losses, again, related to severe weather events or other natural conditions. And that's compared to pre-tax income. And if it's over 1% of pre-tax income, then the disclosure will be triggered there. And then the de minimis threshold for that one is 100,000. So those are the two big pieces. Some of these, you'll also have recoveries. The amounts that I'm talking about there, those are gross amounts. And then if you trigger those disclosures, then you also would be required to disclose any recoveries related to those amounts. So you don't get to include the recoveries in the evaluation of the 1%, but you do need to disclose them. And then I think one thing that was very, a lot of commenters had questions on, and there was a lot of discussion about was, okay, well, how do I attribute different costs or losses or charges to severe weather events or other natural conditions? And so they also added guidance along that, which is that if the severe weather event or natural condition was a significant component of the cost or of the charge, then it would be included in the disclosure and you would include the entirety of the amount for it. So say you have an aging facility and the roof is weakening and probably needs to be repaired. And then all of a sudden there's a severe weather event and the roof collapses on the facility. So you have costs associated with that. So you'd get to use judgment, but if you said, well, the severe weather event was a significant contributing factor, then the entirety of that cost would get included.
All right, that's helpful. And I think, Kevin, one point there is that, you know, as we say shareholders' equity, we say pre-tax income, but it's the absolute value. So if you were in a loss position or you had accumulated deficit, it would be the same. And one thing on these thresholds, and Kyle, I was pinging you while we were watching them discussing the rule when it was coming out. You know, I think at least was surprising to me. I haven't seen before, and curious, Kevin and Kyle, your experience, these de minimis dollar thresholds. Well, two things. One is this 1% that it's so specific instead of based on materiality. And then they're specifying de minimis instead of going and using a company's de minimis threshold. So have we seen this in other types of rules?
I mean, I'm not familiar with it. And it's a little bit interesting because sometimes you could have And we deal with this in other areas of the SEC guidance, like significance calculations for 305 financial statements, where, you know, if you have a company that's near break even.
Yes.
So if you have a company that has a $200,000 net income that year, you know, there's pluses and minuses that lead to that. So, you know, you could have something that's $90,000, so almost 50% of pre-tax income. But because of this threshold, you wouldn't disclose it. I mean, I think it certainly to me is disconnected from any sort of typical materiality evaluation that we would do.
But I think like your point is a good one about this break even notion.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that like, if you're a preparer, you have to go back and really look at your financial statements and say, what's the likelihood that I will have that year? And there's a lot of companies that, you know, cyclical business, you could see, you know, that change. And so you could in a given year be subject to reporting, right? Because it's more, it exceeds that threshold. And that's going to be, and I don't think this de minimis amount does anything really for a preparer. It doesn't really help much, right? Because you're basically saying that you have a $100,000 disclosure threshold. So you have to look and say, well, what's 1% of, so you're looking at what, $10 million?
Yeah, it's not.
So you're kind of in a tough spot there. So I think that's going to be the big challenge for companies, right? Is when they do hit that, and frankly, like, could they say, hey, this is a requirement that only the SEC requires. It's SX. Can I get some sort of, you know, can I try to get a waiver? Can you get a waiver, Kevin, for complying with this? Like you can with 305 of SX and 309 of SX. I don't think you can. Right. These are financial statement footnote disclosures. So in that case, right, you are in a different, I think you have a different issue to deal with.
Yeah. And I actually think to that point, for all that, again, I was saying that the compliance date is not exactly right around the corner. But when you do think about the systems necessary to capture all this information, and again, that'll be in a later episode, but you can't wait and say, oh, well, this happened this year.
We'll wait till 12/31/2025 and start calculating.
Because it's going to be buried in other accounts or otherwise. Right. So you really do have to start planning ahead.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll talk about the compliance dates, but that was fundamental to the timeline that they built, and why they built that time is to allow time for those things to happen. And so I don't think that the recommendation from them would be to wait until, you know, 6 months before the first 10K is due with this. That's the whole point of the extended time.
Agree. Frame. All right. So then I know there's two more parts to the footnote disclosure. So Val, coming back to you for carbon offsets and RECs, renewable energy credits.
So I think the carbon offsets, I don't know if we talked about them in detail outside the financial statements, but you would have details about your carbon offsets and your RECs outside of the financials to the extent that they relate to a plan to achieve climate-related targets or goals. And there is where you would get a lot of the detail about those instruments, sort of the nature of them, the amount of carbon avoidance, how they were generated, the location of the projects, et cetera. But in the actual financial statements, you're going to disclose the related costs. So within the footnotes, you would actually have the costs. So those would be the costs if they're material to a plan to achieve the climate-related targets. So for your RECs and your carbon offsets, that would be the capitalized costs, your expenditures or losses, and that would be a quantitative disclosure.
All right, and more to come on that one in subsequent episodes as well, because I think
because the accounting is pretty straightforward for all these.
Or perhaps not. But what I was going to say is that there also is some in a relationship of a bit of this with GHG, and again, a lot of interest in these types of instruments. To Kyle's point, there is also a FASB project talking about the accounting for those instruments. So a lot more to come on that. All right, last piece for the footnote, Kevin. Going back to you for estimates and assumptions.
Yep. So this is primarily qualitative discussion, and it's really just getting at how estimates and assumptions used in the preparation of the financial statements have been impacted by severe weather events or other natural conditions, as well as how they've been impacted by targets or transition plans that otherwise require disclosure from the SK requirements. And so this, it kind of interfaces a little bit with we hit on in some of the other disclosures. There's quantitative and qualitative disclosures on specifically how estimates and assumptions have been impacted by transition plans, targets, or goals, as well as mitigation and adaptation efforts. So there's a little bit of a crossover there, but the footnote disclosure is just a qualitative discussion. I think that's important. And then the other SK disclosures have introduced the quantitative element as well. And there's a little bit of a delay in terms of when those requirements will kick in outside the financials.
So, Kevin, I think you had mentioned previously when you were talking about the severe weather and other natural conditions that you would be subject to those disclosures. You'd only have to tease out, oh, what part of the cost is related to the severe weather and what's just related because I had to replace my roof anyway.
Right.
And so if I'm thinking about these disclosures, particularly I think when you're in the topic of transition plans, some may be hard to tell. Is that action because you're doing it because of climate, or is it because my consumers' tastes are changing, but are they changing because, you know, and right. So you don't really necessarily know. So would you have that same way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in the footnote disclosure, it's the, since it's more of a qualitative discussion, I think it would just be probably considered in terms of the factors involved there, whether if it was severe weather events or targets or transition plans. And then separately, if you're thinking about the quantitative and qualitative discussion that's required outside the financial statements, there is some discussion in the rule that talks about some judgment that companies will have to apply in that. But I think the rule provides the opportunity for companies to make that judgment and to assess whether those expenditures are and whether those impacts are arising as a result of climate-related conditions, or maybe there's just other things. And so I think of the example of replacing a fleet of vehicles mm-hmm. and you go with electric vehicles. You know, I think companies would have to use judgment. Is part of the reason that they're going to electric vehicles because they have a target or goal associated with emissions reduction? And if so, they're probably going to be included in that.
All right. Very helpful. So then, Kevin, we've already hit on this, but I think it would be helpful for our listeners if we hit it straight on, which is talking about the compliance dates, because we've kind of woven them in here and there. So what are the initial compliance dates?
Yeah, it depends.
Of course. Isn't that our favorite answer?
This might be, I think, one of the most confusing aspects of the final rules. The rules have a chart and our in brief also has a chart that's helpful. So I'd definitely point
just
to that.
Just refer to that.
It's going to depend based on your filer status. So the large accelerated filers will be the first that will be required to have these disclosures. And the first set of those disclosures will be required for any fiscal years beginning in 2025, which is a little bit of a different way for them to put in the effective dates. So beginning in 2025. And so typical calendar year company for their year that begins January 1st, 2025. So it would be their 12/31/25. 10K would be when they include the first disclosures, but that would exclude the quantitative and qualitative items on estimates and assumptions that we talked about from SK, and it would exclude the GHG disclosures. And so the those other disclosures phase in, the quantitative and qualitative specific disclosures phase in 1 year later, and then GHG also phases in 1 year later if material. So all the others kind of flow off that. The next category is accelerated filers. And the accelerated filers get one additional year, the accelerated filers other than the SRCs and EGCs. And then they follow the EGCs and SRCs, and non-accelerated filers follow a year later. And then the assurance requirements, I know you'll talk more about GHG, those kick in for fiscal years beginning in 2029 will be the first one. So that's a little bit ways out in terms of those. And then large accelerated filers, the reasonable assurance level will be 2033.
Yeah, and actually one thing we haven't hit on but is a notable change that I think was recognized by many is important is the fact that there is no comparative in the first year. So this is sort of you do 1 year the first year and then you would add the years as you go along. And so I think that will also make a big difference to companies that they're not going to have to go back. And even though it's fiscal years beginning in 2025, that also would include even potentially 2023 information.
Right. So long as they have not, the only yes. caveat is so long as they have not already included that in an SEC filing, if they have, you know, with the thought being, well, you've already put it in there. So keep putting that in there. But yeah, for the most part, companies won't have to recreate backwards any of the information.
But one of those things about the timing, when we talk about getting a jump on from a timing standpoint, is a lot of the SEC registrants I would expect would be in the scope of California. So I think when you look at, or you think that your accelerated filers are a lot further out, those requirements, the TCFD report under one of the California laws would be due by the end of 2025, and their greenhouse gas emissions would be due in 26 on 25 information. So I think you have to look at it holistically at all of the requirements.
I completely agree. And that is another episode that we will be doing, that Val will be doing actually, in terms of how this, the interoperability, because this is another point we didn't talk about here. And we will, I think, get more into this in some of the subsequent episodes. But it is interesting that, you know, even in the proposed rule, there were questions about being able to satisfy those requirements with, for example, reporting under ISSB. And yet in the final, particularly, we saw this in the actual hearing where they were very specific that they needed U.S. rules for U.S. registrants for, you know, investors in those companies. And, you know, any interoperability may be something for a future date. And I do think that is one point that for many multinationals may be somewhat of a disappointment given all these other rules they're subject to that we'll talk about later. So thinking about these effective dates, I think one of the questions we're already getting is, well, okay, it's effective for fiscal years beginning in 2025. I'm a large accelerated filer, but there's litigation. So maybe I'm just going to wait. So Kyle, as you're talking to companies, well, first of all,
what could happen?
Yeah. Like what have we seen?
There's a lot. I mean,
and so, then what could happen?
So,
although I just want to forewarn our listeners,
I'm not a legal expert.
Exactly,
I only play one on TV,
and also not an expert at predicting things. But
that's right. That I am not good at. Yes. So, so we did see, you know, as of the end of last week. So, what is that? The 8th. We did see there are two lawsuits. There is one lawsuit in the 11th Circuit. There's also another lawsuit in the 5th Circuit. Combined, there are 13 states that are suing. I imagine we could see more. I think, you know, those lawsuits both are looking to block the SEC's final rules. The final rule, in their view, exceeds the agency's statutory authority. And they also are looking at it from the perspective of it's otherwise is viewed as arbitrary, capricious, and not in accordance with law. So that's the kind of the Administrative Procedures Act piece of it. So what does that all mean? Well, you know, there's questions, Wes, just do they have the basic statutory authority to require greenhouse gas emissions disclosures? Is the rule a violation of the First Amendment? So is it compelling speech by requiring disclosures? I mentioned the proposal, the Administrative Procedures Act. Really there, it's do the cost far outweigh any benefits from those disclosures? So we could see something similar to what we saw with share repurchases, where that actually was kicked back from the courts to the SEC. So that's something else that's out there. And then this major questions doctrine, which people have been hearing a lot about. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but I think really the point there is that, you know, the Supreme Court has weighed in on these types of questions. The point being that, you know, if there is a concern or an issue of vast economic and political significance, and Congress has not actually empowered the agency or has empowered the SEC to actually give them authority over that issue, then a certain they could be challenged. And so, and I'd say the final piece is what could Congress do? And so there's the Congressional Review Act. And I know we've talked to our Roz Brooks and the public policy side of things. And if the Republicans were to get the votes in the House and the Senate, they could use the Congressional Review Act to overturn it once it has been adopted, which it has been. So, you know, they could take a look at it and say, hey, yeah, we can get the votes. We want to overturn it. The problem is that would then go to President Biden. Biden likely would veto it based on the fact that this is on his agenda and what he's been pushing. And so that's out there. And obviously there's the appropriations process, which is how the SEC gets its funding. There have been times in the past where the SEC has been directed as part of the appropriations process to not take action on certain things. So that certainly is an option.
Well, and Kyle, we saw that in this rule. There's a carve out in the rule from something that's in the 2023 Appropriations Act. So, I mean, you see it directly.
Yeah. And then the final piece, right, is kind of the noise that everyone is paying attention to, which is the presidential election. And so what happens with that? You know, if President Trump is elected, we could see his administration take action to roll back these rules. So a lot really to be thinking about. I think to your point, though, you have all these global requirements already to sit and think you can kick the can on a lot of this stuff. I think, and this maybe is a question for Kevin, a kind of invalid kind of your perspective. But as I think about the requirements, it would seem that the greenhouse gas emission disclosures may be something that I can maybe the courts would look and listen and say, well, wait a second, are you really the authority that should be requiring this? But the footnote disclosures are always fair game for the SEC because that is under their, you know. So I don't know what have you looked at that and thought about that?
No. I think it's interesting in the adopting release, they actually spent a lot of real estate in the 886 pages. They carved out a few pages to talk specifically about their authority in general and to lay out their view. Not only do they think the entirety of the rules are within their authority, they also think that even if you carved it up into pieces, that each individual piece is. And so they specifically talked about the Reg SX provisions and how Congress, since the 30s, has given them the authority to establish disclosure and accounting principles to be followed by public companies. And so that seems to be, you know, on more solid ground from a rulemaking perspective.
So, Kyle, it's interesting you mentioned as well sort of this cost benefit, because I think we saw that, as you said, with share repurchase, obviously saw how that ended. And it, at least to me, not that I've read that many of these types of releases and focused this carefully on it, but it seemed like a lot of what they did and the modifications they made were sort of directed at the cost benefit. And again, I guess I'll ask both you and Kevin, am I reading that right?
I think you're right there. I mean, I think the thing that I look to with share repurchases is that you already had a disclosure requirement, right? And in this case, you have staff guidance, you have there is an interpretive release that is out there that addresses climate related risks, but all these other disclosures, I mean, this is all, you know, new, right? So I think there's a little bit of a difference there. And I think one of the things the court said with the share repurchase rule was, well, you never identified what was actually wrong with the original rule. And so that was one of the primary reasons. There are obviously a number of others, but one of the primary reasons why they kicked it back to the SEC for a more robust analysis of the cost benefit. I mean, it is an economic analysis, so you can always look and say, you know, economics, like broadly, well, hey, investors want this information. I think this is probably the space you could look at the comments and say, well, hey, commenters are asking for this. Investors want this information. That's clear in the company's comment or the public's comments on the topic. So I don't think you saw that same with share repurchases.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you do have 250 pages of economic analysis to read.
That's enough.
In case you want more. So I know we've only skimmed the surface. Lots more to talk about. But maybe to wrap things up just for today, I'll ask probably a relatively easy question. And I'll start with Val in terms of just what would you recommend companies do now?
I think it's the same advice we would give for any of the frameworks that we've talked about before from an international standpoint, from the CSRD, from the ISSB. I think it starts with a really solid understanding of what the requirements are and then doing a gap analysis to what information you have available. And I think that you can't start that too early, because I think the larger the gap, the more time it's going to take you to figure out a plan and how to fill it.
All right, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, I think building on that, right? I mean, you're talking about putting information in an SEC filing, which carries with it all of the securities laws and all the penalties and fines and enforcement that can come with that, and the importance of disclosure controls and procedures, internal control over financial reporting, and that all takes time. to develop and to put in place. And so just understanding the stakes involved here when you put this in an SEC filing, I do think it's important to get started accumulating that today.
All right, Kyle, hardest for you since you're last?
So I'll build on what both of them said even further than what Kevin did. And I think it goes to Val's point about the gap assessment or gap analysis, which is, you know, the readiness assessment that you know, we like to talk about. And I think it really highlights the importance of the quality of the data, right? So, you know, what you report or the output, right, your reporting of your systems is only going to be good as the inputs. And so you really have to focus on data governance and data quality. And I think, you know, you take a step back, right? Really the important piece here is ensuring you have those controls in place to ensure that the timeliness, accuracy, and completeness of your reporting. And I think when I think about GHG emissions and the conversations I've had with some of our experts that deal with it, it really is the completeness is a big element of that, right? And I think the lack of controls, I think is, you know, it's, I wouldn't say it's alarming, but I think it is something that people should be really focused on and thinking about.
Yeah, and maybe I'll actually chime in on this question too. And I think just building on what all of you guys said, and particularly picking up this data piece and tying it with something we talked about earlier, a lot of our listeners, their companies are going to be reporting under more than one of these frameworks. So they're going to be subject to these SEC rules. To Val's point, they're going to be reporting in California, maybe New York and Illinois if we see those rules or others to come. They may have IFRS sustainability disclosures they have to make as well. And so the reason I bring that up and tie it to data is I do think making sure you have the right controls over the data and you're accumulating data at the right level so you can be flexible enough to meet any of these regimes that you need to will be important, as well as understanding the differences to see where you can use information from one to meet others. So with that, as always, such a pleasure to talk to the three of you. Look forward to having you all back on some follow-up episodes so we can dive deeper into some of these issues. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tune in next week for more fresh episodes. So that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all our latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors, including accountants and lawyers.